Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. We are here. Nikias, salute to you. And then we're going to talk about Kevin Durant's debut with the Suns here shortly. Excellent work from you. I've been told by the streets top two and you're not two.
Oh God.
The GOATIS.
Who?
The GOATIS Duncan. I've been told that as well.
Are we sure about that?
We need more folks like you delivering the good word. Got some money answers from Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, Monty Williams, Steve Clifford. And it was a reminder that the discourse, while loud, doesn't have to dictate everything. And it's a lot more fun to just talk about the game. And the game is heating up. It's been an incredible season. We're headed towards the playoffs. We had another night of what? Like six people scoring 40 points or more? Again? Just casually? Yeah.
Just getting buckets.
Yeah. It's nuts. Let's have some fun. So I'm going to give you a bit free pod. We are going to salute you. Title it Tribute to Nikias. I'm probably something better. That's why I don't title the pod.
Okay. Well, I can confirm that will not be the title of this podcast. I do appreciate the love. It was fun being in the press room. Had been a little bit. Naturally, most of my work is like X's and O's intensive, people that listen to the pod. So like it's me staying at home and watching. So it's nice to get out there and actually talk to people for a bit. Steve Clifford was great. Monty was great. Katie, Devin Booker were also great. Wanted to talk to Chris Paul, could not do so. We'll try it again. but no, had a lot of fun. And basketball in general is fun. I am with you. What's up?
I just typed a free throw. It's a tease for later. Professional. Okay. B, you can't beat the big time allegations. I said bit free. I lied.
Just going to leave that alone. Anyway, let's get into some news nuggets before we talk about Kevin Durant's debut. On the Laker front, it is the beginning of a new month, which means Steve is now contractually obligated to mention the Lakers at least once. LeBron James suffered a foot injury during a win over the Dallas Mavericks. The infamous I heard it pop sequence in which he finished that game and helped close the deal on that game and has not played since. He will be reevaluated in 2 weeks. And from there, a firmer timeline will be established. Steve, your thoughts on Lakers situation with no LeBron right now?
Well, I hope he's all right. I don't want to get too respectfully messy, but hopefully he heals and is able to get back to full strength and help the Lakers make this push. They are a game out of 10 right now. Also a game out of 9 right now. And the trade has had its benefits. We've seen guys step up. We've seen the roster or the lineups make more sense. We've seen more size. We've seen them moving in the right direction. So this could be, once again, all right, let's see what happens in these 2 weeks. And let's see what kind of push we can really make. So I'm going to get this foot right. However, just know if we don't take care of the business we need to, I'm really going to get this foot right.
And that concludes the respectfully messy portion of the program, I imagine. I feel like one, it just stinks for LeBron. And just as a fan of basketball, it is so weird that LeBron is having like human reactions to injuries now. Because this is just not what I remembered in his prime. Like literally growing up watching LeBron at this point, it's like, oh, he twisted the ankle, the shoes are tighter, cool. Oh, no, LeBron's rolling around a little bit. TV timeout. LeBron is now shooting free throws, and now he is guarding your best player with 3 minutes left in the fourth. And so now it's just like throughout his Laker tenure, it's an ankle injury that keeps him out for a while. And like with this, now it's a foot injury that may keep him out for a while. And it's like, it makes sense, Like, he's played the most minutes in NBA history. He's not an all-time leading scorer. You know the accolades for LeBron. But it's just surreal that, like, oh, LeBron, like, he gets hurt now. That's odd. So just as a general note, I hope he is okay, and I hope he's able to get right. For the Lakers, this does represent a unique opportunity for them, especially with Anthony Davis, who missed the Thunder game that the Lakers were still able to win. But is this a stretch where Anthony Davis can really reassert himself as a true born number one option during the stretch, catch a rhythm, and then get hot as the Lakers make this playoff push? That's going to be interesting. Getting D'Angelo Russell back at some point, like, will that kind of accelerate the process with him and Anthony Davis generating more chemistry on the floor? Like, I think that that's going to be interesting to watch. You're going to get more minutes spread out in the forward room with no LeBron there. We'll get to see more usage from Jared Vanderbilt. It's going to be interesting to track, but you listed the standings. Everybody's so close at the bottom, which is encouraging in a way. Like, hey, if we tread water here, we may still be at 10, and then we make the push when LeBron gets back. If they slide at all, they could be 13. And so it's a wild time in the Western Conference right now.
Extremely. And to your point about this opportunity for the Lakers, it's a big one. I mean, now you can allow those pieces to gel together. You have a little bit of wiggle room rotation-wise, because it's not necessarily, hey, who's going to play with LeBron? What are we running? Those kind of things. Let's build our base back up a little bit with this new unit. Let's try and get AD back going. Let's see what the right combinations are, and then hopefully we're in a position where, A, we're where we want to be, and B, LeBron's coming back. So it'll be fun to track. I won't be talking about it until April, but it'll be fun to track.
Well, there we go. Folks, just save that one in your drafts if necessary. If you want to hear Steve talk about the Lakers, this was your one. I guess while we're on the injury note, the OKC Thunder currently riding a 5-game losing streak, 2.5 games out of 10th. They will now no longer have Kenrich Williams for the rest of the regular season after suffering a wrist injury against the Kings. It's kind of tough. No Kenrich, who I have sung the praises of plenty on this podcast, with the way he's able to act as a connector in the half court, takes on tougher defensive assignments. He started some games at center this year. It generally does whatever is needed for this Thunder team. They are going to miss him on the court. Him being out, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander also currently out. Very inopportune time for the Thunder to be missing two of their more important players, and Shai obviously the most important player on the roster. Kind of hurts the play-in chances. Steve, I guess I'll concede the floor to you. But I know you have bars for me for being intrigued with the Thunder play-in push.
It's not necessarily bars,
but
it's more if only. Obviously, you know, we want players to be healthy. So I hope OKC is good. I hope Kenrich is good. I hope Shai is good. I hope they get better. What kind of injury did Kenrich Williams suffer?
I tried to read it, and I was like, huh, I don't know how to pronounce this. I see wrist, and so.
Got you. How many years in a row have the Thunder sent an email with an injury that you have to Google twice?
Look, man. NBA is a physical game. Injuries happen. It's just unfortunate.
Didn't I tell you that these emails are gonna come?
Don't do this, man.
What you mean don't do this? I told you. Hey, look, do we want to talk about when these are coming or not?
Well, you know what I say to that? This is even more reason why you don't take the Thunder off national TV in early November. That's right. We are bringing this full circle. For a team with as much young talent as they have, if you even have the inkling that there will be emails sent out later in the year, yeah, highlight them early before the record is bad or whatever the case may be.
That man hit me with a mean Euro step. You got it, man. You got it, man. That's why he's the best in the biz.
I read the scouting report. Anyway, so transaction news before we get out of here. With it being March the 2nd, recording very early on a Thursday, That means the deadline for players to be waived or bought out and still be playoff eligible. That was on Wednesday. That is passed. Some of the players that were waived ahead of that deadline: Nerlens Noel, that we touched on briefly in the last pod; Goran Dragic; Juancho Hernangómez; Sandro Mamukelashvili from the Milwaukee Bucks. That was a surprising one, but I guess not so surprising considering the roster context. Just didn't think that was where it's going to go this early. But with Juancho being waived from Toronto specifically, that helped facilitate the signing of Will Barton, which is something that you called or made the case for on a previous episode. So kudos to you. I guess we don't have to hang here too long, but your feelings on the fit.
The fit's going to be interesting. Toronto made sense to me just because of what he could bring to them off the bench scoring-wise and solidifying that unit. He's got the size they like, so he could fit in with multiple lineups. How he gets brought into the equation is going to be interesting to me. How long does that process take? But, you know, for them to solidify that wing room and potentially have him and Gary Trent Jr. out there at the same time with those second unit type lineups, I think it's solid. I think it's smart. I think it's a good opportunity for his offense to speak, his shooting to potentially help. And he's got help on the other end. So it could be a boost for Toronto. It could, again, open up some more lineup versatility for them, depending on how many minutes he gets and how he performs. It is Toronto, so we've seen them make these moves and then, wait, what happened? Where'd they go? Where's Thad? You know, that kind of thing.
Tough.
So we'll see. We'll see. We'll see how he gets integrated, but I like the move.
Okay. The big thing you touched on for me is that he's going to help on the other end. I think the biggest reason he fell out of favor in Washington was because of the defense, would be my guess. And Toronto's defense hasn't been great this year. We have discussed, and you especially have harped on, like, what's been going on and what's been going wrong with their defense this year between the pod and the watch parties. But having that much ground coverage behind him, I think, is going to help in a way that it didn't in Washington. And if you feel like there are more lineups in which you're comfortable with him being on the floor defensively, then to your other point, the shooting has more room to help. And Will Barton did shoot well in Washington, and he's been a good shooter for most of his NBA career. And so I think that's going to be important. Having another creator on the perimeter, I think, is also going to help Toronto. So I'm intrigued by the fit. Like, I don't know if he ends up closing games, but I do think he can give you a good 18 to 20. And kind of help be a bridge with some of those second units that have sometimes felt light on creation, mostly because Toronto's just sized up in a way. It's like, hey, here's Scottie Barnes and four other players that could be considered bigs in some way or shape or form, especially when Gary Trent Jr. or Fred VanVleet are off the floor. And so now that you have another guy that's more wing size, but more importantly, can shoot and can get his own shot, I think that's going to help. And shoot, just with him being smaller, that opens up the floor with some more inverted action that Toronto likes to get to. Like, using Will Barton as a goal screener if necessary and get him shaking, shifting the defense that way. I think they're going to find some use for him. As far as the others, like the Goran Dragic waving in particular, I think was something else that we hinted on in a previous episode, following the Pat Bev move, actually. Any landing spots you see for Goran?
I'm doing no research. Does Miami have a roster spot?
They do not right now. That's where my mind immediately went.
Yeah, I can see that. That would be the one for me. Where else? It's a good question. Dallas?
Like, that connection is always going to be there. And now that I'm thinking about it, like, I guess I'll do some live research on the fly. What have the Jaden Hardy minutes looked like as of late?
Ah, I see.
Because there was a stretch where he was getting playing time, and I was excited. And then,
let's see. Has not played since February 23rd. Four minutes against the Spurs.
Ah, I see. So, curious to see if Dallas could generate a roster spot if they want one. Again, the connection with Luka Doncic, I think, is a very obvious one to point to there. Other than that, like, does anyone need a third point guard at this point?
That's the tough part with Goran in particular. It's not as much to do with his talent, but A, which team has the spot for him to play the minutes? And B, what team would he want to go to that has those minutes? I don't think he's just going to go anywhere. And like, that's where I'm like, do I do the math real quick? Like, where does he go? Like, would Philly ? Can't get jiggy with it. That's fine.
It's just kind of, you know, I mean, Milwaukee has the roster spot.
It's too crowded for me there. When would they play him? They barely find time for Javon.
Yeah, that's also true. And Javon's just been good. Can we just say Javon's been good? The defense speaks for itself. The shooting from him is just beyond what I thought it would get to. And it's spot ups and pull ups for him. I've really enjoyed the Javon Carter minutes this year. Like the irony move would be Toronto, but like, I mean, they don't have the spot now. And you know how that went the first time. So that, for very obvious reasons, that will not be happening. But this has been another year where they've been like, hey, who exactly is the backup point guard per se?
I'm going to throw a curveball at you. Oh, go ahead. Finish Toronto.
No. That was the whole thing. It's like, so remove everything else around for that. I was like, I can make the case for it. But because of that, no.
Again, no math here. Denver?
You know, I was thinking about asking like a Goran versus Reggie question. I didn't know how you'd react to it.
I mean, two guards, movement. I could see Denver trying that potentially.
I think I'd get mad about Goran or Reggie getting minutes over Christian Brown in some of those two guards alignment, especially since I think Chanchar is like firmly in the rotation at this point.
He got me there. Let's throw a curveball. It doesn't make any sense. Golden State.
And they currently have the two-way limit hitting them right now in terms of days and games played and stuff. I mean, if they relied on Ty Jerome, surely.
You took the respectfully messy words right in my mouth. I was going to say a whole lot of Ty Jerome, no disrespect. So, I mean.
Here's a vet.
Play on. Why not?
Limited defensively, but at least won't make mistakes defensively.
Not for you there.
Golden State might be a fun fit. You might have something. I don't know. Again, I mean, look, like prorated minimum and all the cap jargon and stuff for the rest of the year, and I don't know what it does to the tax bill and whatever. But
oh yeah, we're not doing no math. So if we're wrong, just let me know. At Steve Jones 20 on the Bird app, just tell me I'm a dumb dumb. It's fine. Portland.
Respectfully,
never mind. Don't say no more.
I feel like you know what my concern is going to be with that.
All right, let's play a guessing game. ... Defense. Did I win?
Yes.
Okay.
Congratulations. So I don't know if I would do that, but I feel you. I get where you're coming from. I do. I understand. I personally would just be like,
That was as respectful as absolutely not ever given me. Appreciate that. I see the vibes are on today. We're in a good place.
We are here. Do you think Mamu gets picked up anywhere? Not for a playoff team, but just in general. Like,
yes. I do think he does. I don't know where it would be, but I could see him totally getting an opportunity. Like, let's say from the Thunder, why not?
Yeah.
Or a team like that. Like, why not roll the dice, see what we got, see what we could do. So I don't think he'll be out. I wonder how much of it was a combination of Milwaukee's timeline plus what they need from a big plus. Oh, we could just do that with Myers Leonard, huh?
I think the easy answer I have to that is yes. Because Mamu is such a funky player offensively. Like, I think that would require just legitimate investment in order to really unlock what he does. And, like, pigeonholing him into, okay, you will just be a post hub. Or you will just be a screener and a roller. Not that he can't do it, but that doesn't maximize everything that he can be. And the Bucks are too good to really indulge him in that way. Like, not that this is a one-to-one player comparison at all, but like I think about how much freedom like Naz Reid has in the second unit in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I think to maximize who Mamu can be offensively, he would need that kind of leeway. And I don't think Milwaukee has the appetite for that, if that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. I mean, there's a conversation to be had sometimes where a team is either on a timeline or has a roster context where we know what you can do or what you could be. We just can't necessarily do that.
Yeah.
Like, and you look at Milwaukee taking Nwora and Mamu and going in different ways. It's like, yeah, there's talent there, but what do you want us to do? Trying with a title, we got 19 of y'all.
Like, ultimately, do we trust Jordan? Do we trust Wes? Well, yeah. Do we trust Mamu or Myers Leonard is large and will be in the right spot in the drop and can shoot?
Well, I mean, it's a simple role for him, and you don't have to play him.
Yeah.
Screen, roll, rebound, space. Defend. Boom.
There you go.
And 6-10 minutes every 2 to 3 business days.
There you go. And as much as I am intrigued by Mamu, the defense, not where it needs to be, especially for a team like Milwaukee who hangs their hat on the defensive end. So, intrigued. Also, quick shout out to Bo Cruz, who gave some interesting minutes to Toronto. I am curious to see where he lands or if he lands anywhere this regular season. We will see.
Hustle 2?
Maybe. Maybe. Are you going to watch Hustle 2 if it happens? Will you watch Hustle 1 before it happens? All right. So Kevin Durant made his debut on Wednesday night against the Charlotte Hornets. A double-digit win, a 105-91 victory over the Hornets. Kevin Durant in a little under 27 minutes, 26-50, if you want to be granular about it. 23 points, 6 rebounds, couple of assists, a couple of blocks in those minutes. The Thunder won Durant's minutes by 13 points. Steve, what were your initial impressions on Kevin Durant in the Suns uniform?
For me, it was just fun to watch the glimpses of what he brings to them. Like we talked about, hey, the Suns are very good, and also they have Kevin Durant now. But now kind of seeing it on court, you can see them trying to figure out how they can play with KD as opposed to just, hey, we have Kevin Durant. And so you can see other things opening up. You can see kind of like not necessarily the mindset shift, but what they could bring to the table. And it's tough. It's difficult. Like the number one thing that jumped out to me was the spacing. The spacing, man. Like the Suns have loved dribble handoff actions for a while now. And then you kind of look up and you see, oh, here's Devin Booker coming off that dribble handoff. The guy on the left wing is Kevin Durant. So that nail help just isn't going to be there. And you have to deal with the empty corner. Huh. Interesting. And Ayton rolling. You got some decisions to make. And then I think there was one time they flowed out of transition. Chris Paul was bringing it up. Side note, Chris Paul got to be extremely happy. I've never seen this man just be like, man, yeah, we good. Let me get to the corner real quick.
Man, go ahead.
So I think it was he was bringing it up, and I think it was for Devin Booker. Kevin Durant and Ayton were running a stagger for Devin Booker. I think KD may have slipped, vice versa. But it was like, oh, you guys can just flow into that pretty casually. And if you recall, A, KD with movement in Brooklyn's been good this year. B, Kevin Durant in Golden State, where they would just literally throw the ball and be like, hey, you and Clay and Steph just run near each other and someone do something. They can kind of do some of that with him and Devin Booker. And it's like, ah, okay. See the engine start running. Dribble handoff where now it's for Devin Booker, but the corner's empty and KD's space by himself on the wing. And it's like, ah. Let's run a little hawk action. KD, be a screener for Chris Paul. Everyone's looking at that. Oh, there's Devin Booker off the stagger on the other side. Huh.
What we like do with that?
and that's where you get the blend. Like, I feel like a lot of the chatter, or some of the chatter, I shouldn't be that guy. Some of the chatter was on the mid-range game and the pull-ups that they can do. And it's like, you got to remember, Phoenix is very good at executing
very good at finding your pressure points, and they just added another element to it. And that was the fun thing that jumped off to me offensively. What were your thoughts live in the building?
Oh, here we go, man. but all of the offensive stuff, like watching KD space and how that affected how Charlotte wanted to help was an early thing. It's like, ah, yeah, this is going to be different. Because like he's essentially replacing like Mikal Bridges in the lineup in this case. And like naturally he's better offensively than Mikal Bridges, but Mikal is a really good shooter. So it wasn't like teams were ignoring him to send help at all. But it was just a different layer of, okay, we actually just cannot leave at all. Because at least with Mikal, and again, we've talked about it, his aggression is perked up, so he's more comfortable shooting against the test. With Mikal, you could at least cheat over a little bit and then try to rotate and say, okay, can we force him off the line? Or will he do the pump fake and then drive? And now we've, you know, got rid of that 3-point attempt. Not with KD. Like, you just can't do that at all. And I remember early in the third quarter, Charlotte opens the quarter in zone. And Phoenix doesn't even really run a zone breaker. The ball just kind of swings. Kevin Durant's on the right wing. He just shoots over the guy that's supposed to be picking up in the zone. And he catches in the three. And it's like, oh, right. This is just a guy that is an all-time great scorer and shooter with length that you can't contest that you just add to the offense. Like, outside of the way that they execute, which, to your point, is a big thing with Phoenix. Like, they have been, you know, the deep offensive rating has been below their level this year, mostly because of the injuries. But at full tilt, Phoenix has been an elite offense in the Monty Williams era. And it's really been an elite offense since Chris Paul's been there. And they just hammer you to death with different ball screens, different handoffs, or just finding a defender like, okay, we're going to make you work. We're going to make you make a decision. And so the fact that they can even go simpler than that and say, hey, Kevin, here's the ball. One thing that Devin Booker touched on, KD even referenced post-game, Monty Williams touched on, like there were some play calls that, you know, KD's still trying to learn with Phoenix. And there are some possessions where it's like he's getting directed in real time where he needs to be and stuff like that. And even within that, if the actual play call breaks down, it's like, all right, Kevin, just go create and shoot over somebody. And he can do that. And that's such a, it's such a luxury to have. To have that kind of security blanket and say, hey, if the defense defends this well, we got Kevin. If Kevin is still trying to figure out the playbook right now, he's still Kevin. And even when he isn't involved, the defense is thinking he's still Kevin. And that just makes it easier for Chris Paul, who I think 2 points in that game, only 7 shot attempts. And you've talked about how he's kind of peeled back on the scoring, period. It's like, all right, let me find DeAndre. Let me get Devin in the spots. Chris Paul now has even more room to do that now. It's easier for if Kevin Durant's on in the corner, it's easier for him to snake a pick and roll and get to the elbow because he's not seeing strong side help or he's not seeing a weak side help now if Kevin Durant is stashed there. And it makes it easier for him too when he does want to generate a shot, easier for him to get to his pull up. Had a nice one over Mark Williams in the first half. That was the bucket for him. Also easier for him to just find DeAndre Ayton on those seals. And so like Kevin Durant is just such an additive to this group. And it's very basic analysis. Like he was in the MVP conversation before he left. Obviously he's good, but like just seeing his effect on and off the ball immediately popped for me offensively.
Now, before we get to defense, which I'm very intrigued to talk about with you, because I know that perked up for you. It's interesting. One, you said that's Kevin Durant. That really jumped out to me when they started the second quarter with him. And I know he was on a minutes restriction. But at the same time, that's where I was like, oh, right. That's a different element for Phoenix. And this isn't a discredit to the Suns' second unit, but preseason started out as, what's this going to look like? I myself was like, okay, Chris Paul with the second unit, is that the best use for him? All those guys grew into their roles and have contributed very well. So it's no disrespect. But now you get to just be like, hey, here's Kevin Durant plus y'all. And that's where you get a reminder of, oh, yeah, Phoenix can run their movement sets. They can put KD in those movement sets. They can post KD up with the second unit. If something breaks down with the second unit, it's not, is Chris Paul going to shoot? Should he be shooting? It's not, Kevin Durant's going to shoot the pull up.
Yeah. He got to tell him to shoot. Yeah.
That's a pretty good security blanket. And it's like, ooh, that's kind of nasty. And now you can kind of bring Booker and CP in a lot. Yeah, I get that. And then I am intrigued to see how it grows between Chris Paul and Kevin Durant. I think there was a possession. I think KD came off a screen, kicked it to Chris Paul. Chris Paul came off a screen from DeAndre Ayton, kicked it back to KD. KD kicked it back to Chris Paul and then set a screen for him. And I'm like, what kind of setups are they going to do? Because you know Chris Paul likes to find matchups and tweak defenses. So
yeah, well,
that's something to keep an eye on come playoff time, for sure. But let's talk about that defense, because I want to hear what you thought about it.
All right. Before I give defense thoughts, just to bounce off of what you said with the KD plus bench units, I think it was 8 minutes of Kevin Durant with four bench players, or at least with no Chris Paul, Devin Booker, DeAndre Ayton on the floor. The Suns won those minutes by 9 points. And to your post-up point, I think Second Spectrum had them at two post-up possessions in the game yesterday. But one of those was on the left side, very early post-up form. Immediate double comes, Damian Lee cuts, gets an easy layup out of it. And it's like, well, that's a way to kind of simplify things. If Kevin Durant's going to be that kind of pressure point with the second unit, that's going to make it easier for those guys who, as you've said, have stepped up this year. They're going to have even easier opportunities now. And if you're getting hit with waves with only one of the stars on the floor, like, again, that was a plus nine in 8 minutes. And so now you bring in the full starting group, which Josh Okogie, fifth starter. Quick thoughts on that?
I'll raise my hand, my bad. Not my bad.
Like, I anticipate it's, hey, let's see what it looks like, and then Torrey, and then I don't know if it's going to be the full thing. So that's why I'm not, I wasn't trying to, like, get you to take an L or anything. I was genuinely curious.
Nah, man, talk that talk.
No,
accountability is important. I came here saying, nah, dog, Torrey Craig for sure, duh. And 33 minutes for Josh, 15 for Torrey Craig. Now, it could be, to your point, they know what Torrey Craig can do, will do, and you can always put him back in, but Josh is playing well. What's that look like with that starting unit? I'm intrigued. I think either way, you have what you need, in theory. Now, the interesting part to me is going to be who separates themselves, and do you want Josh Okogie to start? Not because he hasn't earned it or he couldn't do it, but there are moments where a guy finds a rhythm in a role and then you elevate him and what got him there disappears.
Yeah, makes sense.
And so is playing with that unit going to take some of the aggression off the table, as opposed to now he brings that energy off the bench and now you can slowly or integrate him with that lineup. He can close games. Is it that type of scenario where you have a Torrey Craig who is going to do what Torrey Craig does regardless? So yeah, that's where my head kind of goes. Like, how do you want to handle that to get the most out of both of them? And then, because you got Terrence Ross off the bench, you got Damian Lee. So you got options, but that's probably something they need to figure out on the fly on what they can do there.
Okay. No, that's a good point. I guess to that end, and then I'll move to the KD defense. What would you prefer? Because I think it kind of goes either way. Like, if you're playing Josh with the starters, like, that is the maximum amount of space that he's going to see. And so, like, maybe that accentuates, one, like, the cuts, because you have at least two guys. And depending on, like, what the matchup is, if it's a switch situation, something like that, you have three guys that can draw two to the ball. And that unlocks what Josh does as a cutter. And with the starting group as well, like, he really has more abandoned, kind of flying for offensive rebounds, which has been a big piece of what he's been bringing to the table as well. And on the other end, if it's him being with the KD plus bench units, instead of him starting, you starting Torrey for a little bit more size, like, does that kind of maximize the energy aspect of what it brings? Like, where would you kind of lean on that?
I mean, I would probably lean on, depends on what you want out of Josh Okogie. Like, do you want pieces of what you saw during the stretch? Do you want to enhance that? Do you want him to complement the starting lineup? Like, which version do you want? Because I think it could work either way. But if you're saying, okay, we want to make sure that he's adding even more than just the defense and the spacing and the cuts, I'd probably bring him off the bench. More so because I know what Torrey Craig's going to do. That's no disrespect. It's just I know what he's going to bring to the table. And I know what that starting unit's going to do, So if we have Booker usage, KD usage, Chris Paul usage, DeAndre Ayton usage, whoever number five is, do you have enough of the confidence to play your game with those four, if that makes sense? Mm-hmm. Not that Josh is lacking in it, but you got to learn how to do it. Because it's very easy to be open and be like, oh, now let me swing it to one of y'all. And it's like, well, actually,
we need you to.
That's the one you need to take. And so you don't want to necessarily have him feel that pressure in a sense. Where now it's like, okay, I have to perform, as opposed to you saw the freedom he played with during that stretch from what the at Atlanta game to what the OKC game, where it was like he's just coming in like a wrecking ball. You want that. So how do you maintain that?
Oh, that's good stuff. That's good stuff. Now let's move to the Kevin Durant defense, which for me, watching the difference between him and Mikal Bridges was like part of the fun for me. Because I didn't think there would be a major shift schematically, like Phoenix was still going to switch a bunch. This is something that I asked Monty Williams about after the game, if Kevin's presence is going to lead to a little bit more scheme versatility. But beyond that, like, I did anticipate KD kind of slotting in with the switching. And just how different it is with him versus Mikal. Like, I do think, just on balance, I think Mikal's a better defender. But what KD provides in terms of the size and the length is just so different. And watching Charlotte try to get into, like, some Hayward, Mark Williams pick and rolls, and that immediately becomes a switch. And it's like, huh, okay, that's interesting. And, like, normally, if they did want to switch that, even if it's a big kind of trying to seal there, like, you get a little bit more traction against a Mikal than you do with a KD. With KD, there's, like, he's a little bit stronger. Also, there's just more length. So, like, you don't even have the benefit of, hey, we got a weaker guy on our big, now let's throw it in. You're not challenging KD in that way. And so that makes it different. I want to say around the 8-minute mark of the first quarter, Charlotte goes with an empty corner pick and roll. KD's on the weak side, immediately he peels in over early. And it's like, okay, wait, this is a little bit different. Because they had DeAndre Ayton playing a little bit higher up against this pick and roll. And I was like, huh. Not that it's some foreign or new concept with playing AD more aggressively against those empty corner pick and rolls. But like, do they have more leeway to do that now, knowing if you get this pocket pass in and KD's spacing the weak side corner, now you're challenging another 7-footer at the rim versus Mikal's roaming over, and he can also make those plays. But again, it's just so much different having a presence like KD there versus Mikal. And so, like, it was just, again, similar to the offense, just what his presence kind of unlocks for everyone else. That kind of stood out to me. Then obviously there were the flash plays. He had a couple of on-ball blocks in that game, kind of showcased what he can do in space and what he does on the ball as well. But that's what really excited me. Like, he didn't look out of place defensively. And I do think Phoenix is going to have room to play around with some stuff. Like, KD had a bench unit. We didn't see, like, KD at the five in this game. And I think as he gets off the minutes restriction, Monty Williams said he's going to be on restriction for a little bit as he kind of comes back. But I do think we're eventually going to see some KD at five lineups. Maybe not to close, but, you know, early second quarter. Maybe you don't see Jock Landale, or there was no Bismack, I don't think. But maybe you don't see Jock. Maybe it's KD and four of the bench guys. So I'm just excited to see what Phoenix does on that point. What did you see defensively?
I think for all of the – because a lot – I think if I go back to the immediate reaction is, how's Phoenix going to defend? I feel like that was said. Whoever said it, sorry. But
whoever said it, sorry.
What you lost in the on-ball value from Mikal Bridges, you gain in off-ball value with KD. And kind of bouncing off what you stated, his help really jumped off to me. And how he can be disruptive with his help jumped off to me, especially with the Phoenix team that is at its best when they're defending as a unit. And so what he does as far as positioning-wise, showing his length, showing his body, disrupting drives, taking away space. That has value for Phoenix. You mentioned the ability to be a rim protector, a weak side helper. That has value for Phoenix. And it can also make them a little more switchable, to your point, where it's not necessarily that Mikal Bridges couldn't guard X, Y, and Z. It's just that you needed him to guard this person.
Yeah.
So now KD is in support of the person that's doing that. And that helps their overall team defense. So I think that value is going to be fun to see. I want to see what they do. Do you think this has an impact on the activity that they want from Ayton? Or is this just, we could do more stuff?
When I asked Monty about it post-game, it felt more like the latter. It's like, okay, we can do this. And he was quick to point out, like, hey, you can't always just scheme it that way. Like, hey, KD's on the floor, now we're going to be aggressive, because where KD is spaced or what his guy is doing when he is spaced can affect what kind of help you can provide. And I think that was a very fair counter to that. So I think there is definitely going to be some room for exploring on that end. I think it can have an impact if they do that. I think the skill sets allow for, you know, you just want Ayton engaged, period. Even if he's in a drop, you want him to be able to kind of close down space when he needs to. And if playing him higher up just kind of forces him to have that activity, I think that could be a positive for Phoenix. And again, I think having someone like KD, even if KD isn't the low man on specific possession, like even if it is like Devin Booker, if he's in that corner, like I think KD can, I mean, I think Devin Booker can slide in earlier and be, have a better chance of getting an early draw on the charge or whatever and disrupting that pocket pass. Because if he's in super early, naturally, like the skip pass to the corner is going to be open. If KD's the guy splitting on the weak side, maybe you're not trying to throw that one step ahead pass and dealing with KD's length and the way that he can play the passing lane as well. So I do think, I guess to answer your question, like I do think that could be an impact. I don't know how frequently or how early we see them make that kind of shift, but I would be surprised if we don't see that perk up at some point.
Do you feel better or worse about their defense going forward with KD?
I feel a little better about it. And this is something that I wrote about before KD made the debut. I feel like, again, I think Mikal Bridges is a better defender than Kevin Durant. But I think with what Kevin Durant's skill set is, I think he's able to cover some of the areas that they really needed that Mikal couldn't. Because you wanted Mikal, like you said, you want Mikal to have these specific matchups. With KD, like you don't, if we're looking at like a Dallas series, like you don't bring KD as good as the defender as he is. You don't bring KD in because we want him to be the Luka stopper. And I think because of what KD can do as a helper and just how he can restrict space in general, even if you are giving up switches you don't like, you can show more help or you can get more aggressive with your help knowing that either KD is going to be directly involved with helping or if you're sending extra help elsewhere, if you try to pass ahead of that, KD's going to be one of the guys or the guy to kind of cover up that amount of space. So I think, oddly enough, like I think they're better equipped to deal with some of the mismatch hunting that they may see from a Chris Paul or, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about who the fifth guy was going to be. If that's Terrence Ross, like, not that he's an awful defender, but like he's not Josh Okogie or Torrey Craig. If teams say, okay, let's get Terrence in action, I think KD's equipped to cover for him in a way that Mikal wasn't. The Suns are just going to be really freaking good, I think, is kind of where I land. Like it was a fun showing. It was a fun showing indeed. Any other closing thoughts on the KD experience? What are you looking for with him moving forward, aside from staying healthy?
Again, I want to see how they grow, what it looks like. What are they settling on rotation-wise? Is KD, are they just going to trip into KD in the second unit being the thing? What actions can they do to use KD and Booker together? How did KD and Chris Paul grow? What does KD and Ayton look like? I just want to see where they go from here. So we see kind of the base, the elements of what they do. Now what wrinkles do they add? What's it look like as the chemistry grows? And how do they settle in between that balance of what we do versus what we could do and kind of blend that together down the stretch?
I got you. For me, it's just going to be really just seeing how he's going to be utilized defensively and like what that means for the rest of the group. Like the KD Ayton partnership defensively, I think is going to be the thing I'm keying in more than anything. And offensively, as he gains more comfort in like just what Phoenix is calling, mostly because that's what pretty much everyone referenced post game, like, hey, yeah, he's still trying to learn the terminology. He's still trying to learn what these calls are. And like, as that gets more crisp, what is that going to mean for Phoenix's offense? Like, I think the easy answer is they're going to be really freaking hard to stop. But just in terms of like how quickly they're getting into some of their stuff, like what is going to be the pecking order for the off-ball stuff in general? Is it still going to be Devin Booker getting most of that and then KD's not sliding to two? Or does that ever flip? So just curious on that front. So quick stats offensively, just to kind of seal it. 45 offensive touches for Kevin Durant last night. That was fourth on the team. Chris Paul with 76, Devin Booker with 59, DeAndre Ayton with 58. On those KD touches, averaged 1.6 dribbles per touch and 2.67 seconds per touch. That was basically a dribble lower than his time in Brooklyn and a full-blown second shorter than his time in Brooklyn. Obviously, one game sample size, so not going to extrapolate that too hard. But kind of showcases the difference in the offensive system and how quickly KD was working and what the integration process might end up looking like as we get a larger sample. So we will cap it there, and then we will flow into the mailbag. Thank you to everyone who sent in questions. Again, you don't have to wait on us. If you have basketball questions on the NBA or WNBA side, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com.
Hey, keep those emails flowing. I still don't have the password, but we do appreciate the questions. It does spark good discussion. We love talking about them. I feel like we have a lot of fun with what y'all bring to the table. So please send them our way, and Nikias will filter out the ones that don't compliment him.
Wow. Bit free podcast, by the way. First one's going to come from James. Y'all have already discussed quite a bit of the offensive explosion in the league this year and the possible explanations for it. It seems like many of the top teams are battling to have unsolvable offensive versatility. Boston, Denver, Philly, Sacramento, Phoenix, maybe even Dallas. How likely is it that the defense wins championship maxim is wrong this year? Does the slowdown game matter when lots of these teams are still excellent or even better in the half court? Can't these versatile offenses adjust just as well as defenses over a 7-game series?
James, great question. I guess for me, it would depend on what your definition of defense wins championships is. Can you bring only your defense to the party? Probably not. You're going to want to bring, you know, some food, some drinks, maybe a napkin. You need to bring something else than yourself to the party. Is it going to be important? Absolutely. We talk about it all the time. The playoffs are always about matchups. And this season in particular feels like it's really going to be that, like, times 10. And you're going to need to be locked in on your game plan, be locked into your matchups, your principles, have the personnel you need defensively, have the scheme to work, to anticipate, to react, to dictate, have the scheme versatility to adjust on the fly. It's still a part of the menu. It just probably can't be the main dish anymore. To the next part of the question, that's where I really had some more fun. The one thing I would counter with is playoff basketball is different than regular season basketball. That makes me sound old and musty, my bad. But there's just an entirely different level of preparation that goes into playoff basketball. At least there should be. And, you know, that's one of the questions I kind of want to ask. Like, hey, what's regular season prep look like? But you can't really just ask that. But we'll get there a different day. But in the playoffs, we know you. We know you in and out. We know your sets. We know what you like to flow into after that. We know your lineups, your personnel. We're working to take that away. You don't get that as much in the regular season, or at least not at that same level. Like you'll see it sprinkled in for matchups or as an adjustment as the game goes on, or maybe if we've played, you know, last week or something like that, but it's not to that same intensity level. Because you're trying to toggle between what you do versus what they do. It's a short time frame. You're playing in 2 days, that kind of stuff. It is different when you get to the playoffs. And you are working against a team that is trying to take all of your options away. And if they can't, they're definitely taking the top ones away. And they know where you're trying to go after that. And they know what you want to do one-on-one. So there's still value in that. And I think, James, like the teams you mentioned, a lot of the offensive versatility, that work is to prepare for what's coming in the playoffs, at least in my opinion. They're trying to make sure they don't just bring one thing to the dance so they can adjust, because they're going to have to. It's the playoffs.
I was that dude. Didn't want to cut you off.
No, I mean, like, it's a thing on both sides of the floor. You got to have something in your back pocket, or else it's just a regular season thing that you have. And, you know, we've seen over the course of the discourse that these teams get tagged with, oh, defense is great. Is it going to work in the playoffs? Offense is great. Is it going to work in the playoffs? Like, that still exists. Styles make fights. And, you know, offenses still need that pace, but defenses are working to toggle through that. I want to see what it looks like, because you can't come in thinking what worked here is definitely going to work there. But I will counter, because things are more simplified, because it's a lot of playing outside of the play, depending on how good you are offensively and how good your principles are defensively, I could see how maybe that could be mitigated. But I'm an old person, so I'm still going to go no.
Oh, man. I feel that. One, this is a really good question. Two, I kind of struggled with it because, like, even looking at the last few champions, it's felt like offense has driven it, but it's also, like, you need both. Like, you need a team that is either, like, a top 10 offense and defense, or they're close enough in one of those areas to where you're not getting killed. I will say, just with how the league has looked this year, it feels more like defense solidifies the championship more than defense wins championships with how the league is kind of trending right now. I just think, kind of to Steve's point, the versatility defensively is going to be so important in being able to toggle between, because I don't think there's going to be a real way for you to stop elite offenses. The teams are just so, there's so much shooting, there's so much skill now. It's so difficult to give any player, any team with a star player, like, a steady dosage of the same thing, because they will just take it, they'll pick it apart. And even as a defense, you're trying to take away option one or option two in a playoff setting. Like, option, it feels like the third option for an offense generally is so much more effective than a third option was even 5 years ago. And so with that, like, I don't think we're quite at the bend don't break portion of, like, playoff defense at all. Because again, Golden State was an elite defense. Boston was an elite defense last year. Phoenix was an elite defense the year they made the finals. Milwaukee was the best defense, or right up there. So we're not going to get there. But I think it's, we're going to start approaching a point to where, like Steve said, like, defense ain't going to be able to drive it for sure. And I think it's going to become more important. Like, how often can you set up your half court defense versus how good your half court defense is, if that makes sense? Or does that make sense?
No, it does. Can you load up? Can you dictate? I guess would be the biggest question. Can you dictate terms in the playoffs? Are you anticipating what the offense is going to run? Can you do the things behind that with how teams are playing? Can you make the rotations? Do you have your help in the proper places? Are you locked in on your closeouts? Help and recover? Are you making multiple efforts? That's what's going to matter. And that's where I kind of want to see, once it comes to the playoffs, how much of this is going to be, hey, we're taking something away and we can identify it, versus, you know, we're getting cut up by this. You know, I go back to the Pelicans-Blazers game we watched yesterday. Pelicans were working their tails off to deny Damian Lillard the ball. That man still had 40, right? And that's where we've kind of reached a point at. And I want to see, does that translate to the playoffs? Because the talking point is defense isn't being played. But, man, defenses are trying a lot of different things. It's just a different game. It's a different effort. Think about even 2-3 years ago. How many teams were really doing scram switching? Maybe a handful, right? Everybody, the majority are now. You see teams kicking people out of matchups all the time. So what does that look like? What do teams try to take away? That's, I want to see that.
We are in for a fun postseason, I tell you that. Next question is going to come from Zay. Hi, hello. I have a question about the reputation of shooters and Jabari Smith specifically. Jabari had 188 three-point attempts in 34 college games and shot 42%. Now in the league, at the time of this writing, which I think that was 2 games ago, Houston has played Denver and Memphis since the question was sent in. He has 300 attempts in 57 games, shooting 29%. My question is, with the NBA sample being larger than the college sample, when, if ever, should expectations of him being a great shooter shift? There are a lot of variables that could be creating noise, such as the Rockets' offensive ecosystem and the three-point distance in the NBA compared to college. But I was curious what the general threshold would be for a great shooting prospect to no longer be a great shooting prospect.
Fun question. And see, the thing about, I like about these questions, and I always feel bad because I feel like sometimes we get to a fun discussion, but then I feel like sometimes I get lost in what I'm saying and I don't address it. So my bad in advance, Zay. For me, it's probably multiple teams or multiple stops with similar results. Like, I think context is so important when it comes to shooting, whether it's the shooting perception or the shooting numbers. What kind of shots are you taking? What type of shots are being created? If it becomes the same story in multiple places with different setups, playing against different people with different opportunities, then maybe it's you. Hi, you're the problem. It's you.
No, you didn't.
I did. To the Jabari point, I think it is, there is a difficulty in that if your reputation coming into the league is as a shooter, there is an expectation that you are going to do that. And you were probably brought in or getting minutes because of that, especially if it's a good team. Like I look at Aaron Nesmith in Boston and it was like, hey man,
we were told, comma.
You kind of have to do that to get more of these minutes. And if you're not doing that, you're just going to come sit next to me. Or you look at someone like Corey Kispert where it's like, hey man, where are the, like this was part of the package here and I'm not seeing it. So there is kind of a pressure, and you have to remember it. Shooting is up league wide. Like the days of purely just being a shooting specialist, you got to be lights out if that's what you, that's the only thing you're bringing to the table. Did want to add a few things though.
Okay.
I think we still need to try and like dissect, discuss, understand percentages and reputation and how that doesn't always go hand in hand. And I think when it comes to the perception of a shooter, it's about sustaining that level of shot making. And you got to make enough teams pay to where, okay, everyone's putting it on their scouting report. Everyone's talking about, hey, we can't let him get going. We can't leave him open. And it doesn't necessarily, like, it's a hard thing to explain because it doesn't always come with a great shooting percentage. Because we may still live with those for as long as we can. Now, I point to Grant Williams. You look at the growth that he's made. You know, from 25%, 37%, 41%, 40%. Pretty good shooter now, right? Has it changed how defenses treat him?
Not drastically. Like I think he's being forced into more of those like pump fake, one dribble, take the shot versus just letting him fling. And so like that represents at least some shift from where he was as a rookie. But to your point, like, no, he's not defended like a 40% shooter yet.
And that's where it gets interesting. That's where it gets tricky because you can be perceived as a threat. We're going to close out to you. You know, we're not going to just hand you the shots. We're not going to treat you like teams may treat Matisse Thybulle. But also, you may reach that point of, okay, we're just going to take your threes away. And now what? So, yeah, you still have this great percentage. But instead of shooting five, you're shooting three because we're running you off the line. And that's where it's like, okay, still a good shooter. Defenses aren't treating you any differently because of who you're playing with. Now they are, but they're just taking you off 3-point line. How do we judge and balance that? I mean, because if you go back, I went back to 2015-16. I just looked at the leaderboard real quick. There were 20 players who shot 40% or better. I clicked on this year. There's 39. Patrick Williams shooting 41.3%. He would have been ninth in 2014-2015.
Wow.
Think about that. So, yeah. And then I think it also gets tricky because you just have to be careful because you don't want to cap the potential development of someone. Because we've seen time after time so many guys come in without the shooting label and now all of a sudden they're knockdown shooters. Like if you had told me in college that, like, go back, build a time machine, go to Vegas, tell me that the Kawhi Leonard that I just played against who threw the ball towards the rim and went and got it 19 times would just become a knockdown pull-up shooter. I would have laughed in your face and then gone to get some food.
You want to eat food? Watch
No, yeah, dude. That's funny. I'm not replying to that text. I'm going to go play NCAA football. Anyways, look at what Javon Carter and Bruce Brown have done shooting-wise, making those leaps. And then there's always this element of the willingness to take a three. I don't know how we factor that in. Like Marcus Smart's probably never going to get the shooter label, right? He's made some big ones. He'll make you pay. So do you just have the willingness to take it? Evan Mobley doesn't have the best percentages, but he'll let it fly. Shoot, Robert Horry. Considered one of the... What is he considered? Like, is he considered one of the best clutch shooters of all time? What?
Yeah, he's made a big, made a lot of big shots in his day.
Right? That's a good shot in the cast. That man had some 32%, 30%, 34% seasons.
it's a roll of the dice. So yeah, great question, Zay.
This is a fun question. I like this one. I like this one. I guess I would first reference an article written in 2014 from Daryl Blackport, who I believe is the mastermind behind PvP stats. So I would check that out, where he kind of states, like, well, he found that roughly 750 three-point attempts is where things begin to normalize. And even then, there's still a lot of noise within that 750, but that kind of represents a starting point for him. And going back through the database in Cerebral Sorts, it has Jabari's college stats, some of the pre-college tournaments and stuff that he's been in. Add all that stuff up together, he's at 589 three-point attempts. And so between college, pre-college, and the NBA stint, he hasn't hit 750 yet. And so I would say, like, generally, it's probably too early to say, okay, Jabari isn't going to be a great shooter, or we need to start shifting what we think about him. And as you referenced in the question, the context for Jabari has been really, really, really bad. Independent of, like, what Jabari has done with the opportunities that's been given to him, he also, like, frankly, has just not been good, even outside of the shooting, for a large stretch of the season. So, like, there's stuff he has to work through. He's a rookie, so I'm not concerned. But, like, there's the Jabari portion. There's also the context portion. And within the shooting, that really matters. Because I think what made Jabari such an enticing prospect, period, and if you wanted to steal it to the shooting, it's the multiple ways that he could get to his spots. Like, Auburn was featuring him, and that allowed him to establish more of a rhythm, and that unlocked what he did as a movement shooter, what he did against contests from three and from the mid-range area. And in Houston, that largely hasn't been the case, to the point where it's felt like Jabari is now forcing shots because he just doesn't know when he's going to get another one. And shot selection matters just as much as what your extra shooting touch is. And so I do think Jabari is underperforming what he is as a shooter right now. The percentages on open shots have not been great for him either. So, like, it's bad around across the board for him right now. But, like, a lot of that, I feel like, is the ecosystem. It is just kind of the rhythm or lack thereof that he has. So I'm not super concerned about that. So I would say, I guess it's a combination of the article and what Steve said. Like, I would like to see, one, the sample just grow with him, period. And I do think if it's a sustained, okay, we're in year three with Jabari and he is now up to 32% on five attempts. Is what I would be like, wait, okay, what does this mean? Because, like, off rip, longer three-point line, NBA defense is a little bit different. Like, even good shooting Jabari, like, I don't know if he's going to be 42% early in his career. Because, again, the value you're getting out of him is how well he can knock down things off movement or against contest. And naturally, those kind of shots are not going to be indicative of, like, a 40% shooter unless you are insane. And I would reference, again, not a one-to-one player comparison, but I would reference what Duncan Robinson, what his arc has been in Miami. He broke out in Miami and had the best three-point shooting in Heat history. Knocked down a bunch of threes, knocked down a high clip, but a large majority of the threes that he hit and what made the season so special, a large majority of those shots were contested. And once that went down, the percentages plummeted for him. And now he's also had the thing where he's been missing open shots at a level that he hasn't before, too. So, like, that all factors in. But in general, he was living on a tough diet. In Auburn, Jabari was living on a tough diet. So maybe if there's an expectation to kind of alter, it's what his efficiency was going to be on contested looks in the NBA. And, like, maybe that brings him down from he's going to be a 40% shooter in the NBA at his peak to he's going to be a 37.5% shooter in the NBA. But, like, in terms of how he's going to be guarded, how defense is going to treat him, it's still going to have the effect of an NBA shooter because it's really hard to live on that kind of diet. So I'd say let's give it a little bit more time for Jabari. Let's see if the context changes. Let's see if how he's used as a movement shooter changes and if that perks up, and then kind of go from there. Next question going to come from Pat. Hello, guys. As the playoff push for 2/3 of the league continues, I wanted to ask about the other third of the league at the bottom. However, my question isn't about how bad these teams are, how bad these teams are run, or what they need in free agency or the draft. Instead, the fact that despite the NBA's best efforts, these teams still blatantly tank their seasons in hope of getting a top pick. So my question is this: what should the league do to try and put a stop to this, or are gross tank jobs from teams like Houston, San Antonio, Charlotte, and Detroit just going to continue?
Yeah, I got an answer, but I'm thinking about it. And it's like people go to the lottery. They buy lottery tickets all the time.
there's somebody listening to this pod right now that is opening up their phone and saying, yep, Killian Hayes and Mitchell Robinson about to both get double-doubles tonight. People just try stuff. I still stand on this, and I said it once the plan came in and they liked it. The league got a whole lot of tanking talk out of the way. Like, I think it's easy to forget how quickly things would shift to, okay, we need to shut it down. And the amount of teams that were in that boat at a certain point in the season, the league being able to take some of that off the table, prolong some of these teams shutting down the season, increase the interest for some of these teams that are still fighting. Like, I make fun of Nekias all the time, but the Magic are only 4 games out of the play-in.
That's true.
You have a good week, a couple teams have a bad week, you never know. The Pacers are 2 out. The Bulls are 1 game out of the play-in. They're still making moves to compete this season.
True.
Blazers, Pelicans, Lakers, all battling it out. You've limited the amount of teams that are going to absolutely blatantly do it. And the majority of the teams you listed at the current moment, they don't necessarily have the same talent as the other teams. So it's not necessarily as obvious. You know, if this isn't our time, this isn't our time. Also, Victor Wembanyama is pretty good. Dude, I totally get if this isn't the year and you're not close to where you want to be. Let's see what we can get out of it. Let's see what we have and cross our fingers. What say you?
First, I would say that the Orlando Magic are 17-17 over the past 34 games. I just want to throw that out. Anyway, as far as the...
So they're aggressively mid?
That is a step up from where they were last. Anyway, to answer the question, like, generally, it feels like the teams at the bottom are bad versus we are going to try to lose. Now, as the question says, we're not going to get into how badly some of the teams are run or whatever, whatever. Like, there's a team we could talk about within that 4-team grouping that also has some construction issues, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, San Antonio is just bad. I don't know if they're, you know, I don't know if they're trying to throw away the season on purpose. They're not playing like bad lineups on purpose. Like, they have a young team that they are trying to develop. And I think that's okay from where they were. I don't think tanking generally is as blatant as it has been before the play-in. And so I think the league has kind of made the step to do that. Do you want to alter lottery odds more than they have been altered since the last time? Like, I don't think you need to do that. And if you have more competition for 10 and teams trying to get in, and like, as of now, like, injuries, bad roster construction kind of led to it, but like, you have a LeBron team that is outside the play-in. And so that's, if the Lakers had the same record and they had Keldon Johnson instead of LeBron, like, I think it would be okay, let's slide down to the bottom if we can, versus we have a star we're pushing. If the Blazers had insert young point guard here instead of Damian Lillard and they had the same record, it would probably be okay, let's slide down. But top of both conferences really are really tough. And there are enough teams that are kind of in that middle, like, we're moving away from taking a step up where we want to be, et cetera, that are going to push for the play-in / playoff appearance. So I think the league has already kind of done the move that makes the most sense. Altering from here, and you know what my Twitter ad is, like, I'm down to hear some suggestions, but I think altering from here might swing it too far the wrong way, honestly. I think they've done enough. They flattened the lottery odds some more. They've inserted a whole nother segment of, like, pre-postseason play to try to alter tanking. Also, Wimby's coming. Scoot's coming. Thompson twins are coming. Like, yeah, it's still fair for a team to say, do we want to be 10 and then have to win 2 games and then also have to face Jokic if we get through that? Versus, we have a pretty solid chance at landing a prospect that we will have at least, 7-8 years of team control over, who can help transform our franchise. I don't think it's a bad thing for a team to choose door number 2. I don't really, that part has never really bothered me. even at the height of like the tanking thing. So I don't know what more the league can do on that front without tilting the scales more than they anticipate. We do have a bonus free throw question from Pat. Which would you rather defend? LeBron on a fast break or Steph in off-ball movement? This felt like an easy answer for me, but I'm curious to see what your thoughts are.
Well, it's a good question. As someone, I've told the story before on the pod. Arizona State, I was in college. I had to guard Steph Curry. I was told to do one job late in the game. Don't let him catch the ball and shoot free throws. And 2 seconds later, he caught the ball and shot free throws. So absolutely not. I'm not picking Steph Curry. Have you seen his relocation and his movement? No. But defending off ball is fun. Denying people are fun. The greats, not as much. Like, I'm not trying to be chasing and avoiding getting hit and trying to stay close and be in contact. And now I'm not. I got beat. And now he's turning around while the ball's in the air. I don't want any of that. But LeBron on the fast break, he's either going to dunk on me, I'm either going to foul him, or make a business decision. Maybe I try and draw a charge, or he passes. There's a set of outcomes that I can anticipate. Give me that over having to try and feel like I can keep up with Steph Curry moving around nonstop. What say you?
I am on the opposite end of this spectrum. LeBron James is 6'9", 270. Even if I beat him to the spot, one, I don't know if I'm going to survive it. Two, because I am the Nikias Duncan and not LeBron James, I may not get the charge anyway. And now I just have a knee imprint in my chest. No, I will do my best to run with Steph Curry, because in worst case scenario, I am pointing.
Wow.
Here comes the pin down. Switch out. I got caught. Wow. I got caught.
Yeah, right. Some person who breaks down clips and be like, look at the point switch from Duncan. Terrible guess effort.
Guess what? Somebody was in front of Steph now, weren't they? I'd rather hear, man, Duncan made a bad made a bad decision in the 10-minute mark of the second half versus Nikai, yeah, no, we're still evaluating. We're going to reevaluate him in 2 weeks and see how he's doing.
Well, that means I'm gonna get hurt.
I will at least be in the next game to try to redeem myself from a bad Steph effort.
Come on, man. You've seen enough transition defense. All you gotta do is just give the swipe.
Yeah. And then it's, man, bad effort from Duncan. At least the Steph one. I don't have a if all else fails, depending on who, you know, what the screening partners are, whatever, if I get caught, it may just be illegal screen. And we going the other way. We're fine. I tried. I got lost because of Steph Curry. We got the ball anyway. LeBron, there's no upside. The swipe isn't a real basketball play. It's an aesthetic. Trying to actually steal the ball from LeBron is just going to have my arm going backwards. Step again for LeBron is there's a 99.9% chance I am not getting the call. I'm certainly not blocking LeBron James. As far as I'm concerned, give me the Steph matchup. If I'm getting burned, at least I'll be able to live and tell the story. So, fun question. Thank you for that, Pat. Next one comes from Maxfield. I have found myself watching Russ through a very particular lens since he joined the Clippers, one that I don't think is necessarily fair to him. I want Russ to succeed, and I would call myself a Russ fan, but at this point, I find myself mostly catching when he takes an ill-advised mid-range pull-up or isn't screening off the ball and clogging up the offense. The Russ conversations has gotten to me in the way that I watch him play. Do you have any strategies for how you manage your biases, like Nikias and players' ages or Steve within the early season Wizards?
Well, what I would say is number one, acknowledge them. Like, just acknowledge them. We're humans. Basketball is subjective. It's okay to prefer a certain style or play type or player. And, you know, within reason. Like, don't be blind to what's actually happening. Don't defend it until the end. That's a different level of bias. But if you prefer what you prefer, I get it. Tying it back to the Russ conversation, the toughest thing for Russell Westbrook right now is the bad stuff is extremely loud and timed poorly. It's usually in constant. Like, how many times in the last 2-3 years have we seen him make a defensive play, push in transition, and then something happens? and now it's oh no. Or the team is trying to rally. Here he comes. He takes a pull up and misses it. But the miss is like off the, like the right side of the board. And he's on the other side. And it's like, oh. Like, it's just it, like I feel for him because it's like I get what he's trying to do. Mm-hmm. He didn't complete it. And to some may look horrific. And it's like, what are you doing? So I would just say in that particular case, know that part of the Russ package is going to be some loud things. And you got to try and just mix in and see what else is happening. You can't let that just be the only thing. You can't just wait for the one thing that everyone's talking about. That's why I kind of like, I don't like groupthink. Like I like thinking opposite of things or at least considering different opinions. So that way I don't just automatically think of one thing. Like that's one thing I like to do to manage quote unquote biases. Having this podcast or hearing different opinions. It's why I don't like to present myself as like, I am the one, I am the expert. Although maybe I should. Maybe people stop talking me crazy, but
I mean, if anyone could do it, you would actually have some qualifications to continue.
I was missing some. See what happens when you see what happens. You talk to Kevin Durant. Now it's some. Ah, I see.
Ah, here we go. Oh, brother.
But I think it's one of those deals where it's just like you've got to hear different perspectives because this basketball game is all about growth and learning. Like you never stop learning about the game. If we're talking about like specifically like people biases or something like that, I guess it gets interesting. Because like sometimes the biases you have may allow you to see something or understand something that goes past the surface or other people can't see. Like there's got to be someone who always loved Jose Alvarado's game and knew it would pop and yelled from the rooftop when they were proven right. You know, like it, like there are certain folks that I won't go to a certain place with, but analysis is analysis. So if something is happening on the court, it doesn't mean it didn't happen. You know, I just don't have to call him a bum. Like I'm never going to say anything bad about Mike Conley ever in life. But hey, man, if it's one of those games where the defense says, hey, come switch 6-7 post up, that's part of the package. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't change that. As long as it's not a personal deal, that's part of playing, it's part of coaching, and it's part of covering it. But acknowledge it. Be honest at the start of your conversation. Like, I'd rather talk to the person who is a diehard Jokic fan and can't stand Joel Embiid for no actual reason. And now I know what kind of conversation I'm having. As opposed to, no, these are facts. That's another thing. We got to, like, let your subjective thoughts start a conversation as opposed to, no, this is right. This is right. I have found the thing that's going to make this right. Because, see, the problem is when you do that, you get yourself in a pickle when you have a bias that works against you with that statistic or anything that you used. Now I'm pointing at you like, dog, what happened here? Well, that was, no. Just acknowledge it.
I think that's the big one. Like, acknowledge, because if you recognize, hey, I'm hyper-focusing on Russ, then that puts you in position to take the steps to not hyper-focus on Russ. And I think generally, if you can hyper-focus on a player and what they're doing and how they're affecting the offense or defense, you can also just do that elsewhere. And so, like, even with Russ, if you want to make a subtle shift, like, okay, Russ is clogging up the offense. How is Paul George and Kawhi Leonard reacting to Russ? How are they enhancing Russ? Even if you want to keep it on a Russ focus, at least you can now shift it to the other side of the coin and see some things, and maybe some other stuff pops for you. Broadly, I expect, if depending on how this came to be, if it's just you said the Russ conversation really gotten to you, like, do what I do when I'm trying to binge watch a show that I'm super behind on. Like, if you're on Twitter like I am, like, I am tweeting from the notifications tab, so I'm just not seeing my timeline. And so now I can still get my thoughts out there. I can still have fun. And if people interact with something that I said, I can respond directly to that without seeing something I'm not trying to see. And so if you are watching a Clippers game and these are some things that are standing out to you, tweet your thoughts without seeing, well, Russ is XYZ, or these people are hating on Russ because XYZ. You can just avoid that. Watch what you watch, tweet out what you're seeing, and kind of go from there. You can kind of filter your way out of some of the discourse. You're not going to be able to completely eliminate it. It's just, it, especially with Russ, it's just loud. And so, like, you know, if I could brag a little bit, like, I feel like we do a good job of kind of bringing the balance to both sides on that conversation when we talk about them on here. But, like, the SteelNet, we're still talking about them. So, like, you're not going to be able to completely get out of that. But there are ways you can kind of filter your way out of some of the stuff.
And another way, another thing I'd say is whatever your biases are, go in knowing that you're going to see them. So that way you won't be looking for them, if that makes sense. Because film, you can manipulate film any way you want. If I want to go out here and pick a player and say they're a bad defender, I could probably go find 10 clips that make it look like they're a really bad defender. But if I go in saying Yusuf Nurkic can't play defense, and this isn't a shot, just pull the name out of the hat.
I mean,
I may look at the tape and be like, see, I told you he can't play defense. When really, okay, dude just made a really good pull up. And that was the first play of the game, and they're in drop. Maybe they adjust. That kind of deal. Just let the game speak for it.
Let the game speak for it. There we go. Also, just a quick shout out to Max Field for throwing out the the bias shots at the end of the question. Me and player ages and Steve with the Wizards. I love that. That's good stuff. That's a long time listener right there.
Early season Wizards. Put some respect to my name. Come on.
Early season Wizards. That's true. That is what the question says. All right. we have a 3-pack from Mike. If you could create a brand new award, what would it be? And who do you think should win it for this season?
Lord, looking at the discourse, the last thing we need is another award. I would go with the It Doesn't Matter award.
For the league's best isolation score.
Just the person who is just taking whatever you're trying to do and just doesn't care. They don't care. It doesn't matter. Throwing you over the top rope. I don't care about your game plan. I don't care about who's in front of me. I'm going to work, and you got to figure it out. Now, trying to figure out who would win that this year, very tricky. My mind went to Dame first. Then I was like, you could do the traps and deny, maybe. Then I went to Luka. And I was like, he got Kyrie now. He might pass the ball. And I was like, is it Giannis? And it's like, does him shooting pull-ups take him back? Is it Shea? Like, I don't necessarily know who that would be. Is it KD? Because it really don't matter.
Yeah. You know who the actual answer is?
DeMar DeRozan.
Well, also, well, all right. I think if we're taking the award in the literal sense, the answer is just Kawhi Leonard.
It's a good shot.
Kawhi Leonard. It just, not only does it not matter what your defense does, it doesn't matter what he does. You know, he walks in, I am taking a 17-foot jumper. Oh, you're denying me? That's bad. I am taking this 17-foot jumper. I am making it. Am I happy about it? No, it's just another 17-foot jumper. We're getting back on defense.
Actually, now that you mentioned Kawhi, I kind of want to shift it to just who's the most casual bucket getter in the league? Like, forget ethics. Who's the most casual bucket getter in the league? Like, Kawhi would win it for me. Jokic would be up there as well. I mean, casual, not like the ability to get it, but the fashion they do it.
Well, you're just going to walk up here and just, okay. Kawhi, like, I'm just not even here. All right.
Kawhi is hilarious, man. That man will bring it up a transition, take one dribble, see you still back there. All right, I'm going to shoot this three.
Trailer get off the ground, line drive jumper goes in, and he just trotting on back. Hey, match up. I'm like, okay. So that's just, brother, you have 31 points on the 14. You ain't going to say nothing. You just, that's it.
Okay. Yep. Come off the stagger next time. Here you go, buddy.
Oh, geez. No, that's a good shot. I like this question. My mind immediately went to defense. I was like, huh, could we actually get the all defensive third team? That would be cool. And then I was like, wait.
No, wait. Do I trust?
I was like, hold on. Do I trust that this will be handled with the care that is necessary? because there are so many. Like, I dropped my updated awards piece yesterday, and I felt so bad for Cleveland. I'm just like, they have been an elite defense all year, but there have just been individual players that have had better years than like Mobley or Jared Allen. It's like, man, it stinks not having them on a team. Like, they should be. And so, like, I feel like those front court players will make a third team. You maybe get Draymond on the third team, get some of the other guards on it. Like, that would probably be the one if it could be handled responsibly. And I also thought about a previous mailbag question we got about a defensive six man of the year. I think that would be cool. But that also annoyed me as I thought about it, because I was like, you know, we should already be factoring in defense for the six man of the year award instead of going to NBA.com, sorting by points per game in the reserves and saying, hey, this guy scored a lot, their team was good, this is the winner. I just don't think that's how it should be done. So I think I'd land on I would land on the all defensive third team. I think that'd be cool to add. Like, it's always kind of struck me as odd that we have three all NBA teams and only two defensive teams. I'm just like, are we going to highlight 15 or are we not going to highlight 15? That's where I would go there. Second question was for me. Nakai, as you mentioned that the 2008 and 2011 MVP was wrong on the last pod. Who do you think should have won those instead? For 2011, like, I think LeBron should have won it. But if not LeBron, I would have went with Dwight, honestly. And in 2008 is Chris Paul. Like, that was 07-08, that was just Chris Paul's year. I am sorry to upset anyone that they may upset, but that was his. As for the third question, Jokic is arguably the greatest passing big man, but who else would you have in the top five in history? I would say he's the best, but I'm hedging it so I don't cause more Jokic discord. I respect it.
That's a good shot. Arvidas Sabonis. He's number one for me. Bill Walton. I mean, you could pick a Gasol, but I'll pick Mark. Okay. Wes Unseld. Chris Webber. I want to put Wilt and Bill Russell up there. That's about it.
Okay. Before I also had Arvidas Sabonis. I also had Bill Walton. I had Chris Webber and Kevin Garnett. And as we were talking about pre-show, I was like, wait, who are we considering, like, fours? And I was like, wait, what is Larry Bird in this discussion? Do we count him as a big since he played a lot of four? Or is he just like big wing since he played some three as well? And that was a different league back then, playing with McHale and whatever. I think we can consider Bird a big. Like, I think he's very clearly in that top five. Where would you have Draymond in this discussion?
Up there. Definitely others considered. Others receiving votes.
Others receiving votes, like the honorable mentions. Good stuff.
Where would you put LeBron?
Well, it depends on, like, again, is he we give him four, which makes him a big? Are we making him, he's played the three for the majority of his career. If we include LeBron, like, LeBron is just, if we include LeBron, LeBron is at worst second. The real kicker is, like, I'm not kicking that hornet's nest, but, like, there's a very large player who is one of the greatest passers, if not the greatest passer in history. That, you know, we can debate the positional designation a little bit. We're not going to do that on this podcast. Next question is going to come from Michael. Other than Jokic, who are the best outlet or hit-ahead passers in the NBA today? Is this a skill players can develop over time, or is it a mindset you either have or you don't?
I still go Kevin Love. For me, is it a skill that players can develop over time? Yes, but it also depends on what type of team you are. And I don't know, like, how many of those we'll see, especially as we move to more bigs grabbing rebounds and pushing themselves and now flowing into stuff. So I don't know if it's going to become a lost art or what.
Got you. Outlet hit-ahead passes. Kevin Love is a good shout. Kyle Lowry, still very high up on the list, or should be very high up on the list. Josh Giddey, very, very good at it. Who else would I like to throw out there? Jokic, naturally. You did say other than Jokic, so. Those would probably be the three that I highlight off the top of my head. I do think it's something that can be worked on. You can simulate the grab the board, turn around, fling a pass, someone streak on the wing, especially if you already know what your transition principles are, like where guys are going to be spacing or what lanes are going to be filling generally. But you can kind of drill that and get better at that. The mindset, I do think, kind of bouncing off what Steve said, kind of ties into what you want to do. This is a team that generally wants to bring it up and execute versus pushing it. If you don't have the players that can handle that responsibly, like that might shift it. So we will leave it there, though. Last one going to come from Sean. Hi, guys. Which four players would each of you choose to play pickup basketball with you? Current or former NBA players? Obviously, they are the best versions of themselves. Mine would be Boris Diaw, Kevin Garnett, Marc Gasol, and Larry Bird. Huh. Steve, who would be your four?
My four? Mike Conley, Tony Allen, Zach Randolph, Marc Gasol.
That is incredibly on brand. Wow.
No, I did a real one. I thought the bit would hit. pick up basketball, right?
Yes.
I had a tough time leaving Devin Booker and Klay Thompson off my list. And now I'm reevaluating my list right now. I'm going James Harden. I'm going Damian Lillard. I'm going DeMar DeRozan. I'm going Kevin Durant. I had Giannis on there, but it's pickup. So let me get some bucket getters.
I got you. For me, gotta have KG. If for no other reason than for antics and trash talk. But also, this is the best version of himself. Like, this is gonna be insane.
You trying to get cursed out?
No, but the other team, however. Oh man, but no, we got KG down low. We're booking that with Chris Paul, and then as far as my other two, KD and Melo were the two I thought. Like, we're gonna get a bunch of size in the front court. We got Pete Chris Paul. I am going to say congratulations, guys, when shots are made, and set some screens if necessary, and gonna have a good time.
But give me your team one more time.
Before I picked were Chris, Melo, KD, and KG.
Chris, Melo, KD, and KG. I like that team.
A lot of size, a lot of spacing. Got the bucket getting. Length on the floor, you know. We got enough.
You know what the real answer should be, honestly?
Go ahead.
Shaq.
Yeah. Who else? No, that's it.
I kind of want to do an alternative team now.
Shaq, absolutely, yeah.
All right.
Do you have free throws?
I do. Do you?
I do not.
Oh.
So if you would like to.
All right. All right. Let's see what's up. Let's see me back on the train. When he said I felt the pop, do you mean his foot or his patience?
Yes.
Okay. Better Dylan Brooks fit this year, Brock Lesnar or Stone Cold Steve Austin?
The answer is no. And also, let's do some live research on the podcast. Because one, when I saw that, I was like, what the heck? And then my second thought was like, this man better drop 30. I need 30 points from Dylan Brooks to even begin to justify coming in with the Stone Cold energy against the Houston Rockets. For that matter, if we glass shatter and at least make this a TNT game against a playoff team, Dylan Brooks finished with 16 points on 5 of 10 shooting, 4 of 8 from 3, plus 15 is minutes. You know what? That ain't 30. That's fine. Continue.
Well, now here's my thing. Are you ready for the kicker?
Okay.
Sorry, I'm doing live research. He wore the Stone Cold outfit on Tuesday.
Ah.
A TNT game versus the Lakers where he shot 2 of 11.
Ah.
Had 7 points, 5 fouls. Now.
Okay. Did that? Then we bring it back then.
Now, wait a second, though. Because
I believe he wore the Brock Lesnar outfit. Was that also the Laker game?
I think that was the Laker game.
So, which is also funny though, because it's like people are like, "Oh, Brock Lesnar has the Dylan Brooks outfit on," and it's like,
"That's not." There's a level of fame here. I don't think that's also timelines exist.
So I don't think he's performed well in either of them. So maybe he should just try and be The Rock or something like that. I don't know. Give me a Batista next time. Can anyone top calling him Austin 3 for 16?
No.
Okay.
Tremendous content.
That was great. Also, how does one exit the arena if you lose in that outfit?
Well, I mean, the fans will provide the beer at that point.
Zach LaVine had 41 points on 14 of 20 shooting with 0 assists against the Pistons. Was Patrick Beverly right?
he was on to something, I guess.
And is all Zach LaVine needed was support.
Oh, gosh. That man told Billy, you know, you got to sleep with that. Pat Bill, like, hey, bro, don't worry about nothing but shooting the ball. And at that moment, Zach LaVine felt seen.
Hey, man, it's validate your people, support your people. 3-point shootout. Who are you taking, Dwight Howard or Julius Randle?
Okay, hey, man, I can only go by what I've seen. Got to give me Dwight.
Okay. Did the Atlanta Hawks really want Jay Crowder, or did they just see him at Georgia Tech once and sent a text?
Hey, what's up, bro? Hope you've been good. Scene at 9:37 p.m. okay.
So what if Zion comes back and the Pelicans start to groove again and they feel right, and then they face the Utah Jazz in the play-in?
That'd be so unfortunate, dog. Like the one team they can't see in the play-in.
Is Mitchell Robinson correct that he is the best center in New York?
No, he's not. But I respect the confidence.
Is he the second best center in New York?
Is this Mitchell Robinson versus Ben Simmons?
Potentially.
Oh, God. Shoot, man. I mean, Mitchell plays. So, I mean, by default, I guess you got to give it to him.
Who's the third best center in New York?
Actually, let me rewind. Let me rewind for a moment. I believe Jonquel Jones is the best center in New York. Let me get myself right first and foremost. I think Jonquel is the best center in New York. After that, I would say Nick Claxton is still better than Julius Randle. I mean, not Julius Randle, but Mitchell Robinson. I guess Mitchell can be third.
Are you prepared for the Asia Wilson Stewie MVP debate?
Again?
Yes.
I feel like it may be better this year because Asia's already won one. I mean, she ended up winning it this year. And so, no, it's still going to be nasty. No, it's going to be nasty. Nope.
Who's going to try and get more buckets, Sabrina or Kelsey Plum?
Well, one, a quick shout out to Kelsey Plum. Got married to Darren Waller, I think is who it was. Cool. So two rings over the offseason. Well, I guess three with Team USC stuff. But beyond that, I think Sabrina's still the answer.
Joe Harris or Duncan Robinson?
No. Probably Harris, but the answer is
better. No. Better idea. Playoff P or podcast P?
Can I say, as someone that does not personally have an issue with it, is there a star in the NBA with worse optics of starting a podcast before the playoffs than Paul George?
Let's think about that.
I'm trying to think of someone who would get a
Dylan Brooks
star.
Oh. Well, does being a star in your own mind count?
Not in this case.
Okay.
Pat Bev already has a pod.
James Harden?
Oh! That's a good alternative.
I won't say the name because reasons, but if number 12 came out with the podcast right now.
Ah, I see. Ah.
Would be the optimal timing.
Yeah, that would, yeah, that's probably the one that darn it, man. I have titles for the pod. I can't do that though. Did you have more mailbag questions?
Again, excellent work with your questions in Charlotte. What are you going to do if you find out Chris Paul can't stand you?
You know, just shake your hands. Like, okay, cool. Get in line, Chris. I don't know.
Funnier call out. Police, or security?
That's an amazing shot. Police still gets it for me. Help!
Oh, man, was dead serious.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Hey, I got a question for you.
What's up?
Since 1990, what do...
Oh, my God. Dog. I erased like 6 different quotes. And I was like, you know what? I'm just not even going to add to the discourse. This is all so freaking stupid, dog. The discourse itself is stupid. But once we get into things that can quite literally be verified by a Google search, it is one thing to have an opinion that people may disagree with. It is another thing to just be incorrect in a literal sense in multiple measures. It's just odd. Also, it's so funny that the year that Dirk won, Nash should have had one, but it's just odd. At this point, I just want Giannis to win MVP so everyone else is just upset. Never mind the fact that Giannis is a worthy contender for the award. I just want him to win it because the conversation between the other two top candidates has just, it's just been so stupid. It's just been dumb.
For real.
Okay. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community. We're having fun discussions in there. Join the Dunker Spot online watch parties via watch playback. We are having a lot of fun. Analysis, antics, whole lot of antics. More antics than usual, actually. But analysis is still there. We watch it hoop. Come have some fun with us. I will provide the link in the description of the pod that will either be hyperlinked. You just click on that, or you know, hold it down, copy, paste, put the link in your browser, get in there. The sign-up process is very easy and also free. No shenanigans. Come watch some hoops with us. Have some fun. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
The hashtag is big time, folks.